unionofegoists.com is a historical, biographical, and bibliographical resource for egoism. For a definition of that, I turn to my comrade, Trevor Blake, from his book, Confessions of a Failed Egoist.
Egoism is the claim that the individual is the measure of all things. In ethics, in epistemology, in aesthetics, in society, the individual is the best and only arbitrator. Egoism claims social convention, laws, other people, religion, language, time, and all other forces outside of the individual are an impediment to the liberty and existence of the individual. Such impediments may be tolerated, but they have no special standing to the individual, who may elect to ignore or subvert or destroy them as he can. In egoism, the state has no monopoly to take tax or to wage war.
And now I want to discuss one individual in particular. Sidney E. Parker was a British anarchist turned egoist. I have recently begun researching him as a person, but his writing, to some degree, has been known to me for a few decades. He was born in 1929, but very few people I've spoken with even knew for sure if he was still alive. I can confirm that I recently learned from his family that he died in 2012, around Christmas time. I'm not sure how he is best known, but I would imagine his most high-profile work is his introduction to the British 1985 Rebel Press edition of Max Stirner's The Ego and Its Own. His own biographical sketch from Svein Olav Nyberg's Non-Servium Journal, issue number 13, is as follows. Born in 1929, Birmingham, England, now retired after 30 years with British Rail, has worked his way through the Young Communist League, 1944 to 1946, the British Federation of Young Cooperators, 1946 to 47, and virtually all the different varieties of anarchism, 1947 to 1982, to emerge as his own man, the penny of conscious egoism having finally dropped. Editor and publisher of Minus One, Ego, The Egoist, Ego, 1963 to 1994. Non-Servium, issue number 13 and 14, were also the last issue of Parker's own Ego journal, and the 150th anniversary of Stirner's Einzige being published. My first exposure to Sidney Parker's writing was the introduction to the Lumpanics edition of Ragnar Redbeard's Might is Right. It was culled from an article published in issue number 13 of the New York egoist and gay liberation journal, The Storm, which was published by Mark Sullivan, who also ran the McKay Society at the time. Sidney Parker is an important modern figure in egoism. It's his research and writing that I believe has kept many historical figures from disappearing entirely. Had I only paid attention to the biographical note at the end of my 1984 edition of Might is Right, purchased sometime in the 1990s, I could have found Benjamin D. Cassiers, Max Stirner, Malthus Seklu, Dora Marsden, and others decades before I eventually did. Parker published Benjamin D. Cassiers at least as early as 1968. Now what follows is an interview conducted with Sidney Parker on August of 1991. The interview was part of a series about the British libertarian movement and was filmed by David Botsford. Mr. Botsford was not able to complete the project, and Sean Gabb of the Libertarian Alliance was given the master tapes. Mr. Gabb digitized the interviews and uploaded them to YouTube, and he has granted me permission to use the audio for our podcast, and I thank him for that. The interview has not been edited for content and is presented as shot. You can hear an unmiked Mr. Botsford asking questions, sometimes barely audible.
Question four. Who was Max Stirner?
Max Stirner was a 19th century German philosopher who wrote one book which attracted great attention in his day and has attracted a good deal of attention since that time. He was a school teacher and was involved with what's sometimes called the Left Hegelians, and particularly a club of intellectuals who call themselves the Free, who used to meet in Berlin in the 1840s.
How would you summarize Stirner's main work, The Ego and Its Own?
The Ego and Its Own really sets off with a big question by Stirner. He's asking why it is that throughout history, and at the time he was writing the book, we are always asked to work for other people, to serve the cause of other people, or even, in fact, to serve the cause of certain abstractions, such as God, the state, society. We are to serve them, their cause. We're never to serve our own causes. And he asked this question, well, why should I, in fact, serve the cause of God or the state or society? Why can't I serve my own cause? And he decides in this introductory note, I will serve my own cause. I will now announce nothing is more to be than myself. And from that standpoint, he examines the kinds of ideas which were current in his day and in the past. And he directs scorching criticisms at all of these ideas, arguing that in fact what they are fixed ideas, that they are ideas which we are not to have, but which are to have us, and we are to serve them, and we are to deny ourselves in their service.
Thank you. What were Stirner's intellectual connections with classical liberals such as Adam Smith?
That's difficult to say. Firstly, it is true that he translated the works of Jean-Baptiste Say and Adam Smith into German. He was to have written a commentary on these writers, but it never appeared. But he didn't say beforehand that it was to be critical. So I think we can take it that he didn't accept all of their ideas, that he wasn't in fact a disciple of theirs. I think why he's being connected with them is primarily because Marx and Engels, in their vitriolic onslaught on his book, The Ego and His Own, which appeared in their book, The German Ideology, claimed that he was a representative of the German petty bourgeoisie, of their anxieties and so forth, and that he was in fact simply restating the ideas of Adam Smith and of Bentham. That's grown up, and the general Marxist attack on Stirner has been simply that he's a representative of a small capitalism and not the great rebel which they said he claimed to be.
Thank you. How would the practice of egoism actually make a difference to an individual's life?
Well, egoism as conceived by Max Stirner would not necessarily make very much difference to an individual's outer life, his relationship with other people. What it would do is make a great difference as to the way he or she looked at their lives. In other words, whether they were conceiving their life in terms of serving an idea, as I've already said, or whether in fact they're now serving their own interest. It's not so much a call to sort of parade down the street in outlandish clothes, waving a big banner saying, I am the great rebel, but rather a call to you to examine your own motives and to look at the reasons why you do things. If you, in fact, regard them in the light of serving your own interest, your own satisfaction, that, as I've said, you may not notice any very great difference, but equally you could. That would depend entirely on the individual as to how he or she shaped their lives in the light of it. But it need not necessarily mean this. I mean, one German commentator said that, from what he saw of it, any individual who accepted Stirner's ideas would not, in fact, necessarily seem to behave any differently after he'd accepted them than from before.
What themes do you examine in your magazine, The Egoist?
Well, I look at various ideas which come up, ideas in particular in connection with Stirner and how people look at him. I've published quite a lot of criticism of various academic commentators who have tried to slot Stirner into various niches, which they favour, and examine what they said. I also publish articles of related interest to egoism, regard to morality, to how people have seen their lives, and so on and so forth. And from time to time, even a few poems written along egoistic lines. Of course, the poet may not have known that, but at least it seems to me that they were written along those lines.
So, can I just get a chat? Okay. What insights can an egoistic analysis give in understanding politics and economics?
Well, that's not an easy question to answer, because every egoist regards him or herself as unique and therefore will have their own particular view on things. I think from my own point of view, what it does is gives one an insight into what lies behind pronouncements by politicians, by priests, by public pundits generally. The whole point is that what most of these pronouncements are simply statements of interest. That is to say, I want people to behave in this fashion because this would serve my interest. But of course, if you put things in that fashion, that doesn't sound very impressive. If you say, I want you to behave like this because it is in the interests of the country or society or the cause or revolution or morality or whatever particular fixed idea you profess to be serving, then of course accepting your ideas. Instead of saying you aren't agreeing with me because you don't share my interest, you are now saying you are a sinner because you're not accepting the word of God, or you are a criminal because you're not accepting the cause of the people, or so on and so forth. So what it helps to, in my view, is a realistic view of how and why people behave as they do. You strip away the myth and try to find out what the reality is behind what they're asking you to do.
Thank you. Did you say you didn't want to answer number 7?
That's right, yeah.
Right. How would you criticise arguments for egoism, such as those of Ayn Rand, based on concepts of morality and natural rights?
Well, what I have to say about Ayn Rand is I've read her works, and I tend to agree with what an American conservative said about Ayn Rand once, that she urges people to act according to their self-interest as long as she is allowed to determine what their self-interest is. And I think that behind all of her talk about egoism is a very distinct moralistic perspective. And that's what she's asking people to do, is to behave according to Ayn Rand's conception of what good behavior is. As an egoist and therefore as an amoralist, of course, I reject this basis. As for natural rights, those are things which I do not accept, nor did Stirner. He was quite vehement in his rejection of such an idea. The concept of their human beings born with certain rights granted to them by nature strikes me as simply another variant of the old religious belief that God gives us rights, except nature is substituted for God in them.
What would be an egoist's approach to the concept of property rights?
Well, again, the egoist approach is that rights as such are myths. Basically, they would agree with Thomas Carlyle, who said that there aren't any rights but mights. And therefore, what property one has and what property one can hold depends upon one's ability to get it and keep it. So therefore, property is something which lies within my power to obtain and hold. It's not a question of any right.
What would be an egoist attitude towards libertarianism as an organised movement for an increase in individual liberty?
Again, that would depend on the particular egoist involved. The whole point about conscious egoism, of Stirnerian egoism, is there isn't any party line. You're not committed to any particular approach. all you are concerned with is to find that particular approach which you think will satisfy you the best. Now, therefore, if an egoist saw in the libertarian movement something which served his interests, something which, in fact, satisfied him, then he would support it. But there's no commitment on the part of an egoist towards such a view. He could quite equally support an activity which probably the libertarians would call authoritarian if he or she saw in that something which would satisfy their interest.
Do you think that an egoistic approach can be of help in psychology and the treatment of addiction?
Well, that's a new one to me. I must admit, I've never come across this. Most of my time was spent with dealing with people who sort of tried to psychoanalyze or give a psychiatric account of why Stirner wrote as he does write. And there are some very weird interpretations of this. So to ask, could it be of value to these sort of approach is a new one. And the only, I mean, as far as I know, nobody's ever tried to incorporate any Stirner's insights in it. There have been efforts on the part of one trendy sociologist, at least, to see in Stirner a precursor of Freud, which I think is rather dubious. The only actual value I've seen was the account of a man called Francis Sedlak, who was a Hegelian philosopher who, in his youth, belonged to some revolutionary movement in Czechoslovakia, I think, got himself imprisoned, thought that life was worthless and he would commit suicide. Then he read The Ego on His Own and decided that life was worth living after all. But in view of the fact that he came out of prison and afterwards wrote some very torturing and obscure works on Hegelianism, I'm not at all sure that that was a beneficial use of The Ego on His Own. Having tried to read his works, I would have had a stroke against it.
What would you say to the view that it is immoral to look after number one?
Well, I mean, as an amoralist, it doesn't mean very much to me. I mean, I look after number one because number one is me. What most people mean by this, of course, is that if you look after number one, you're therefore going to ride roughshod over other people. You're going to cheat them. You're going to use violence against them. You're going to use all these sorts of things. It doesn't follow in the least. I mean, true, though, moral reason why I shouldn't use these means of getting what I want if I can do it. And the important thing from Stirner's viewpoint isn't so much what people say they want or say they can do, but whether in fact they can do it. He lays great emphasis on competence. So therefore, though I might be competent to violate people's privacies, I might be competent to use violence against them, it doesn't follow in the least that looking after number one results in that. I might find that I get a great deal of satisfaction from people's friendship, from loving them, and so on and so forth. And as long as these satisfy me, then that's okay. I mean, I'm quite willing to accept these as my qualities and to try and find the means of satisfying these things. The only thing that the egoist is concerned about is that no one says that anything, in fact, is forbidden to him. He might, in fact, view the old thing, you know, that everything is permissible, but not everything is expedient.
What would you say to the view that if everyone practiced pure egoism, all forms of social relations break down and many individuals would rob and kill at work?
Well, the problem with that sort of question is the assumption, everyone. This is what many ideologies have. They have the assumption of, as one person put it, mass rationality. In other words, if they have a particular view of life, which they ardently desire to see realized, they assume that all people can eventually be won over to their point of view, and then they engage in schemes of what would happen if. Well, I don't think that the kind of view expressed by Max Stirner, the kind of view I hold myself, is likely to appeal to very many people. It isn't something which most people can grasp. Stirner himself once remarked that the born shallow pates are the most numerous amongst men. And I think this is the case. So this sort of question is okay if you want to engage in word juggling, but doesn't mean very much to an egoist. An egoist lives in present time and seeks present satisfaction. He's not concerned with projecting some utopia in which what he thinks ought to be is.
What would you say is the view that the maintenance of social peace depends on the general acceptance of certain non-egoistic principles by the population at large?
Well, that's more or less in the same sort of category. I mean, we've got to face the fact that the population at large will continue to entertain what you call non-egoistic views, and consequently they will be to varying degrees controlled by ideas which they think they ought to obey. Certain, they'll be caught in a net of conceptual imperatives. Now, of course, you might be worried about this. I used to be, but nowadays I don't. I accept the fact that this is the case, and I accept the fact that if I can make use of such a thing, then I will do so. Now, I'm not out to try and convert the whole of the population to my point of view.
Would an egoist get involved life extension and psychonics?
Well, again, this depends on the egoist. Speaking for myself, I wouldn't. Others might. I mean, as I said, there's no party line. I can't state what others would do. I can only state what I would do about it.
Right. I was just thinking that last question, you didn't actually mention life extension. Could you say it again?
Yes, it's just like when we actually come to edit, so you can smart, I mean, you might...
Okay, yes. Well,
yeah, just say some people.
Well, whether an egoist would get involved in life extension entirely depends on the egoist. As I said, there's no party line, and though I wouldn't, others might. I can't speak for them.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, it's as
I just wonder, were there any points you wanted to make that you thought were relevant?
Not particularly, no.
Okay. I mean, I was just going to say, just, you know, to sort of play devil's advocate, I mean, what would you say if, for instance, would you, under any circumstances, help somebody else, for instance, you know, a kid who was drowning or something, and would you save them? Or, you know, these sorts of questions, would an egoist ever do that kind of thing?
Well, there's nothing to stop an egoist doing this kind of thing. In fact, it isn't... The trouble is, and this is what Max Stirner made a very big point of, is that when people talk about egoism, they have in the mind the old contrast of God and the devil, except that they make God into altruism and the devil into egoism. But he says these are hoary conceptions, they don't really relate to it. And that if an egoist saw a child in difficulties, then if he felt that child's state upset him, then he would move to rectify that. It isn't incompatible. In fact, you would go further. I mean, Stirner actually says that in relation to friendship, that an egoist can risk even life itself in relation to friendship because he is concerned that friendship be preserved because it serves him to preserve it. And rather funnily, I once came across a statement rather similar to that by a 19th century American feminist who was talking about the family and children. And she said, well, I would give my life for my children, but I wouldn't live for them. In other words, if her children were in danger, she would risk her own life trying to save them. But she would not live for their sake, she lived for her own sake. And I think that's generally the egoist view.
Brilliant. Okay, I think that's pretty much the whole lot, really. I mean, should we? Yeah, it's okay. I think that's pretty much the whole. I can't think of anything else.
I'm not offhand. I think
that's
about right.
That's good. Should we say just one question, just to go back to the whole topic of the video? Insofar as an egoist looks at and is interested in what's going on in terms of politics, economics, and so on, Are there any, would you be more favourable to a sort of free market type of society, or a society in which there's a greater degree of state control? Should we just ask that?
You can do, yes.
Okay, or would you just not be interested in those questions?
Obviously the question of what sort of society, with a small s, he lives in, is concerned to the egoist insofar as he's living in that society. But he doesn't in advance commit himself to one particular view of society. His view of society, the egoist view of society, is how far the particular arrangement of society which he lives in suit him or not. And therefore he will look at each of the measures proposed and to the extent that they're being practiced, what the results of these measures are, as to whether they do benefit him or don't benefit him. There's a misconception, I think, that Stirner fits into the libertarian tradition, just as there's a misconception he fits into the libertarian anarchist tradition. But in fact, he doesn't. He is a truly miscellaneous man. And though you can ransack Stirner, certainly, and find ideas expressed which appear to support libertarianism or anarchism, you could equally ransack him and find others. There was, in fact, even a Nazi philosopher who managed to give a Nazi interpretation of Stirner. How he managed that, I do not know, because I never read what he had to say. But you must, in order to understand Stirner, it's important to see him as a whole and not to just take out of context certain statements which appear to support particular viewpoints. He certainly, for example, criticised the state, particularly the state as a sacred idea. You could find certain ideas of his which are very similar to those put forward by anarchists and libertarians. But he also came out with statements, for example, that I am not interested in the liberty or equality of men, only in my power over them. And that what I will get by force, I will get by force. These are not statements which, in my view, are compatible with anarchism or libertarianism. I think the reason why Stirner has been called an anarchist and libertarian is mainly because it was the anarchists who were responsible at the end of the 19th century in bringing Stirner to the notice of people. And therefore, they naturally tended to read their views into him. And this is how it's been taken up by various historians and commentators since. But I don't think it fits if you look at Stirner's basic position.
Okay, yes, another couple of things actually occurred to me. What were Stirner's views about education?
Well, his view of education was expressed in a essay called The False Principle of Our Education, which was actually written before he reached the position he had in the ego on his own. But what he did was he took up what he considered to be, I think, the humanist and the classical views of education. The classical views was, of course, the traditional view that you must learn about ancient Greek and Rome and so on and so forth. The humanist view was that you ought to learn a practical trade as to how to deal with life. And his position was then that, in general, he tended towards the humanist view. But he thought that both views were not his view. He objected to what he called the authority of the school teacher, but he equally objected to the view that the school teacher should let the kids do just what they want. He said that you should be able to oppose your will to the pupil, but you don't have to act as an authority towards the pupil. He didn't treat of it very much in the ego in his own, except to criticise the idea that you should stuff young people's heads with a lot of silly notions about the world in which they lived. Something to the effect that they then end up by twittering like the old. But he did develop, after this essay he wrote, he didn't write at all on education that I know of.
Another thing is, were there elements of egoism in authors prior to Stirner, or did he come to these ideas and they were just sort of, you know, very much...
Well, there were elements there. I mean, some people have traced his ideas back to people like the sophist Callicles in ancient Greece, who argued that might made right. And certainly, I mean, you could look back to that, you could probably find others have found some of Stirner's in Hobbes. I think the point was what he did, whether he was aware or not at least, he certainly brought together certain ideas and he gave them an original synthesis. So that I can't see anybody who would exactly be a precursor of his, though obviously there are elements which he picked up and he used from previous philosophers.
And how would you assess the general impact of egoism since Stirner's time on the world?
That is a very difficult thing to say, because the only indication you've got really is if people say, yes, I am an egoist. But there's no reason why they should say this. I mean, I am a person who's interested in ideas and discussing ideas, and so naturally I come out and say, yes, I am. But though Stirner's book has gone through many editions in various languages, there doesn't seem to be much visible evidence of his influence. But as I said, one can't say how much. I mean, a man may say, yes, that's the sort of creed for me, but do nothing other than simply accept it and look at life through those eyes. I mean, I remember years ago I met a British Rail porter who looked rather like Andy Capp. And much to my surprise, he suddenly came out and said, oh yes, I've read Stirner. He said, I remember I was sitting on a park bench and the old world seemed to turn upside down as a result of reading him. And as far as I know, that was all he was prepared to say. I take it that he'd had a great impact on him, and I take it that he looked at life through those eyes. But after, he didn't say anything more, he never said any more about what he did or whether he applied it or not. He's the sort of person where I think you can say, yes, he's had an impact, but no, he's never made it public. Of course, there are other things. I mean, people have tried to slot Stirner into various things. I mean, you've had him as a defender of the petty bourgeoisie, as a precursor of existentialism, as a precursor of Nietzsche, as a precursor even of fascism. You name it, Stirner's been blamed for it. But as I've said, he's a miscellaneous man. I don't think you can fit him into any category.
Okay, just one other thing I was interested in. What about the scientific or biological nature of the ego or the individual? I mean, I was thinking of The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins, where he argued the genes are the selfish thing rather than the individual. It's the genes that the individual carries which act selfishly in a biological sense and seem to replicate themselves.
Yes, I know Dawkins' view, and I also know that I think at the end of his book he does say something about the fact that though our genes are selfish, we don't have to be selfish, which of course Stirner would ask, why not? But of course Stirner wasn't concerned with that very much. He was basically took himself as he was and took other individuals as they were, and he then developed his position from that rather than searching for some biological or cosmological justification for his view. He wasn't unaware, I mean, though he wrote before the development of genetics and questions of heredity, he wasn't unaware of the fact that they made a difference. I mean, he does say that a born poet will be a poet whether he's in the village poet or at the court of Weimar. He also, as I said before, argued that the born shallow pates are the most numerous. So it's quite obvious that he acknowledged something of these things. But I think his general position was, well, this is me, I am here, I am unique, and I'm going to take it from there. Or should I say take it from here?
Okay, I think that just about sums it up, really.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Okay, right. Yeah, I'll say we've really been through really sort of your own attitude towards libertarianism and classical liberalism.
Yes.
So I swear that's really it. I mean, that was, you know, stop at that point. It takes 10 seconds to get to speed. Okay. What is your involvement with secularism, and how does that fit in with your Stirnerite point of view?
Well, I first got involved with secularism in my teens, and I've kept a sort of on-off relationship with them ever since. The Stirnerite viewpoint, as you put it, is basically that he was very critical of the equivalence of the secularists of his day, mainly people like the philosopher Feuerbach, who talked about man with a capital M, and so did Bruno Bauer, who was a theologian and became an atheist. But Stirner pointed out, and I agree with him, that what in fact they do is they throw out the Christian God, but replace it with another God, which they call humanity or man, and they ask us to serve this. Hence his famous remarks, atheists are pious people. And my view, I mean, I've spoken to quite a few humanist groups, as they call them these days, even worse than secularist, but always I put forward the view that to be an atheist, which I am and which Stirner was, does not involve you in substituting something else for God, that this idea that you must serve humanity is as bad as the idea that you serve God. God, in Stirner's view and in my view, and service of God and service of humanity are just as much fixed ideas. As indeed, as he pointed out, service of mammon, that if somebody is obsessed with the idea that they've got to accumulate material goods, they're just as possessed as the people who think they have to serve God or some spiritual essence or other.
And another thing actually which leads on from that, do you think that an egoist might under some circumstances be in favour of a sort of de facto acceptance of rights, in inverted commas, you know, as it were, property rights, or a sort of delineation of property rights or human rights, in inverted commas, you know, as a means in which people can in fact achieve things they want to do and to avoid, you know, violence or whatever over in disputes over what they might consider to be their property or things that they want?
Well, an egoist could accept these things insofar as they served him. I mean, for example, if somebody laid it down that it was his right to be able to do certain things or to acquire certain things, and if he was concerned to argue a case before people who are supposed to judge those sorts of cases, then he might accept it as an expediency. But he would be rather like the Jesuits, who were prepared to go along with certain things while making mental reservations. I mean, I, in my job, serve as what's called a staff representative. In other words, I'm supposed to represent the people in the place where I work with the management. And obviously, when I'm conducting negotiations, I'm not going to run and say, well, look here, you lot, if you don't give us what we want, we're going to beat you up in a back alley. I speak the language of the negotiating table, you see, and therefore I do that as an expediency, without myself believing that these concepts have any validity. They're simply, I've used them at this time. So please don't show this video to my manager.
Sure. Okay. I think that sums it up then. Thanks very much.
If you are interested in reading some of Sidney Parker's writing, I recommend Enemies of Society, an anthology of individualist and egoist thought by Ardent Press. If you peruse the table of contents of Enemies of Society, you'll actually see that there's a significant number of articles pulled directly from Sidney Parker's own journals. That is all for episode 1 of the Union of Egoists podcast. Thank you for listening. We will, in the future, include more archival audio, as well as producing new content. Please subscribe to our feed by going to unionofegoists.com/podcast.
Deep in my heart and deep in my mind, deep in the depths of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know. You may criticize me, try to analyze me, put me in your little pigeonhole. I'll still hold the key to the place where I am free, a world that only I control. Deep in my heart and deep in my mind, and deep in the depth of my ego, lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know. I can love you dearly, I can love you too, I can love you long and love you well. But I must have my own song, only me can sing, my own tale that only I can tell. Deep in my heart and deep in my mind, depth of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know. Place me in your prison, put me in your cell, lock me up and throw away the key. I will up and wander, whim and fancy free, in this big world that's inside me. My heart, deep in my mind, deep in the depth of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know. Treasure chest, a world that only I can know.